So we're carrying on in our journey in Exodus, and this is the last in our series before Christmas as we head into Advent next. For some reason, I have a little toy dinosaur up here. I don't know why, but I was wondering why my iPad wasn't sitting. It's just a little kind of inside reference to what's going on in my head. Like, why is that not sitting there? Oh, it's a dinosaur, obviously. So we're carrying on in our journey through Exodus. We've been traveling through with the Israelites and Moses, and it's been some journey up and down hills and left, right, and center, facing plagues and all kinds of things. And we're coming to a crescendo in the journey this morning where we believe that God speaks to us at all times, but particularly as we hear about the story of God's people, that we resonate with that this morning as we go through Exodus. And particularly in Exodus 13, 17 to Exodus 14. And thank you to Roxanne for reading that long passage. But it's good to have scripture being read and to hear that narrative. But we're going to be looking at a bit of Exodus 13 in a moment first. And then going into Exodus 14, but not covering every single verse due to the time that we've got. And covering what we're going to be doing this morning. Okay, so this morning we're thinking about a God who delivers. And what I want us to do is to think about three main areas as we go through this. The first is thinking about direction. Secondly, about disappointment. And thirdly, about deliverance. Direction, disappointment, and deliverance. And just before we turn to the passage, direction or guidance is such a big thing in our life, isn't it? You know, we might wake up in the morning and it's like, what am I going to have for breakfast? Is it going to be cereal, toast, poached egg, whatever it is? You know, what bus am I going to get? Or what shoes am I going to put on before I even get the bus? Where am I going to go? What am I going to do in terms of subjects at school? What am I going to study? What exams am I going to do? Am I going to go to college or university? If I'm going to go to college and university, will I get a job? If I get a job, will I keep a job? If I've got a job, will I need a new job? Am I happy in my job? Do I need another job? Am I in a relationship? Will I ever be in a relationship? Will I get married? Will I stay married? Will I have kids? Will I not have kids? Will I be a grandparent? Will I not be a grandparent? All these kind of questions that we have, which go around the sphere of what it is to be human, but in some ways a slightly reductionary in that God is so much bigger than just these questions that we have, and the world has these questions as well. So they're not particular to Christians. But direction is such an important thing in your life, in my life, because it takes up so much of our thinking and our time. And so we either choose to worship in these situations or we worry about these things and these questions that we have. And so what we see is we see the people of Israel in this passage is that they are grappling with direction and seeing the truth that God's ways are not always our ways. And if any of us have been through any trial in life or going through a trial in life, you will quite quickly realize that God's ways are not our ways, that we don't always have it all pinned down. So when we turn to Exodus 13, 17, we read, which wasn't read for us, but I thought I'd just read these verses through the slides. Exodus 13, 17, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. So right away we see that they might have thought logically, well, the direction that we're going to go is from A to B. But what we see on this map here, with these tricky names that Roxanne did so well on, is that they arrived in Goshen, the fertile land of Egypt, and then they traveled down by Succoth, and then down to Pi Hahiroth, and then across the Baal Zephon. Okay, eventually, I'm jumping ahead in the story there. But they went what they would seem to be the long way round. Why not go from here to here? And so in amongst them, as is with us, there'd be the kind of strategists and the kind of planners, and they'd be going, whoa, hold on a minute here. I know God is telling us to go this way, but clearly he's not quite worked out his maps and his strategy planning here. I mean, I reckon that if you took this A road and then you came off at that junction and you went down that A road there, you'd get there far quicker. So, I mean, God clearly doesn't know what he's doing here, does he?
And that's often the case, isn't it, in our lives when it comes to direction. Because some of us will clearly say, well, I don't know. I haven't got a clue what I'm doing in life. And others are like, well, I've got it all nailed down. You check out my diary. You will see every single minute of the day is color-coded. I've got it all going on. I know what cookie I'm going to have. I know what I'm going to have for cereal. I could tell you in 2 weeks' time what's going to be happening, what I'm going to be watching on Netflix. I've got it all nailed down. And God's like, well, I don't quite work that way. You see, it's not about all you having all your plans nailed down and you thinking that your direction is the best. You see, I've got my ways. And so he led his people. And this is the key word in this section. He led. God led the people. And so what we have to do in life is realize that we are being led by God rather than God leading us leading God. And for some of us, we're natural leaders. We're business people. We're working civil service. We're involved in leadership and we like to lead. But ultimately, it's God who leads us. All of us are followers in that sense. We don't lead above and beyond God. God leads us. And that's a good thing. As we will see as we go through this passage, it's a good thing for us that we're not in control, we're not in charge, because if we were, then we'd be in deep trouble. But God led the people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea, so he gave them direction. And we also see this continuity in Exodus 14, when we jump down to 20 here, that after, it should be Exodus 13, is it 13 or 14? No, 14. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead to them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. So again, the operative words here is that they were led by God, and that the pillar of cloud guided them, but the pillar always went ahead of them. Notice that the pillar of cloud or fire at this point always went ahead of them. Neither the pillar of cloud nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. So the pillar of cloud that they saw in the day would lead them and guide them, and the pillar of fire would lead them and guide them at night. Now that sounds like a really obvious Sunday school thing to say, but the position of it is so important, is that the cloud and the fire lead the people. They follow the presence of God rather than the other way around. And again, it can be in our own life that we think, well, if I just do this, if I just say that, if I just go this way, then I'll somehow God will do this for me. But the presence of God leads us and led his people. The cloud went in front of them. The fire went in front of them and guided them. They were being led by God rather than the other way around. And the direction of this and the point of this direction is so important in the story of God and is so freeing. And so we find in Exodus 14:10 that as Pharaoh approached the Israelites, they looked up and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? And so going from Exodus 13 and then down to 10 here in Exodus 14, Pharaoh has just said, as we heard in the reading, that actually I'm going to go and get these people that are doing these services for us, or effectively our slaves. I'm going to go and get our slaves back. So Pharaoh approaches them, and as they see him coming, they were terrified. As they saw the Egyptian army coming, they were terrified, as probably we would be if we had left an empire like the Egyptians and thought that we were being let go, and then we saw the army coming after us. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. And then in this terror and in this disappointment, they begin to look back the way. They begin to look inwards and backwards. And they say, well, were there no graves in Egypt? Were there no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? And we can quickly see these parallels, can't we, in our own life. You see, if life is going really well for you, if you are at school and it's going well, or if you've left and you're at college or university, or if you're having nice holidays, or if you're having nice food on the table, then it can be easy to kind of have God as just one of these other things that happens in your life, or that church just becomes another thing that you do in the week, and even increasingly, sadly, in the Western world, can even become a burden for us. Oh, we're going to go to church today because actually we're having such a good life, it's going to impede on my social life somehow. But when life is hard and is difficult, the challenges come on us and we get a clearer perspective, and we have a choice in these matters to either worship God because he's created us to be worshipers and to trust him and to glorify him, or to go inwards and backwards. And the choice is that we either look up to him and trust him, or we go inwards and backwards. And they at this point became disappointed with God and disappointed with Moses. Were there no graves in Egypt? What have you done to us? Why are you bringing us here? The blame starts to happen. The grumbling starts to happen. We see that in our own life, don't we? When we know that we're not walking closely with God, when we're not worshiping him, when we're not being led by him, when we start to look inwards and backwards, we become moany and grumbling and short-tempered and irritable and not loving and kind, and we don't demonstrate the fruit of the Spirit to those that we love and to those who are around us in the workplace. Because disappointment and bitterness crept into their life at this point, and it can creep in to our lives. And this disappointment continued when it said in verse 12, "Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." I mean, what an absolute crazy and untrue thing to say. One, they never said that. And two, they are just becoming more and more deluded in their disappointment. Because effectively what they're saying is, we were slaves and you brought us out of slavery, but now we want to go back and be slaves again. We were slaves, but you brought us out of slavery, but now we want to go back and be slaves again. We would sooner go back to the life that we know, that is familiar, than actually come out here and die in the desert. And again, there's ridiculous parallels with us in our lives, isn't there? You see, Jesus has come and died and risen again in order that we might be freed from slavery. But we attempted to go back to the familiar and live like slaves again, to be no different to the world, to be lovers of money, to be full of lust, to be lying, to be deceitful, to be jealous, to be envious. And we're all these things where we become enslaved again. Because in some ways, let's be honest, it's the easiest thing to do when we give in to the flesh, to just go back to that point where we're in slavery, because it's familiar to us. But it's a misunderstanding of the gospel, because the gospel is not that you will come to Christ and you will change your behavior and somehow be a better person. It's, as I've said before, that the gospel is that we were dead and we've been made alive. It's not that we just become a little bit better. We were dead and we've been made alive. And so therefore, the changes that come about is that we're brought out of slavery and given freedom. And so we don't return to slavery. And so the Egyptians were saying in their disappointment, well, you know, we'd be better off just going back to what we knew. We'd just be better off going back to slavery. At least we knew we'd get a square meal there. At least we knew where we were. But my goodness, you know, we might actually get ripped apart here. We might be killed by the Egyptian army. But in the middle of all that, we read in verse 13 that Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still." And isn't that amazing? How different is that to our strategic planning or 2-year plan, 1-year plan, 5-year plan, whatever it is, that he says, don't be afraid in the middle of this chaos where the army is coming against you. Don't run. Stand still. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still. And for many of us, we would either run like crazy in that situation, or we would fight back. Because we would want to be in control somewhat of a situation that would only be disastrous if we did it on our own strength. But God says to them, don't be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to stand still. And so the radicalness of what God says to us is that actually in our busyness and in our 101 plans for self-fulfilling happiness or whatever it is, we only need to be still. In other words, we only need to recognize, give God his worth and worship him, because we've been made to be worshippers. A disciple is essentially a worshipper and a follower of Jesus. In the one commentary, helpfully says here about what is called the discipline of delay, the discipline of delay. And Raymond Edmund refers to the discipline of delay in his excellent book, The Disciplines of Life. He writes, we live in a restless, impatient day. We have little time for preparation and less time for meditation or worship. We feel we must be active and energetic, humanly effective. We cannot understand why inactivity, weakness, weariness, and seeming uselessness should be our lot. It all appears so foolish and futile without plan or purpose. And then he makes this profound statement that the delay that instructs and prepares us saves time, never loses it. The delay that instructs and prepares us saves time, never loses it. And so there's something glorious about delay that causes us to be attentive in a world full of distractions. And one of the blessings that we had in our time of sabbatical over the summer was thinking about this area of what it means to be attentive to God in a distracted world. You see, we're constantly on our phones, we're constantly on our iPads, we're constantly getting notifications, we're constantly getting bleeps and information coming in our way that's trying to distract us away from actually stopping and being still and paying attention. And I'm convinced that though social media and the internet is great, I'm convinced that it's actually more often than not a bit of a blight on communities and in our own life. It's something that gives us anxiety, that's something that may encourage envy or jealousy about he's doing that or she's doing that or they're going there and I'm not there. And so the reality is that we need to be still and attentive to God, because then we know who we are in terms of being made in his image. We're not to be people that broadcast our lives and say, well, check me out, I'm great. This is just going to massage my ego when you just give me so many hearts on Instagram. I'm just going to feel so much better about myself. Or I'm just going to feel devastated because nobody put a heart on, because I wore a new dress and nobody put a heart on that. Or I put a new suit on, or I even wore a tie. For me, that's a rarity, and nobody put a heart on my Instagram page. What a devastation. My life is over. Seriously, come on. But yet, this is the stuff that destroys people's souls in the age that we live in. And we need to pay attention to God and know that we are loved by him and worship him. Know that we are people who can delay and can listen and know that our security is in him. And so in the midst of the noise and the chaos that they were experiencing, God said, you want to know how you're going to live? You want to know how to be free? Well, you just stand still. Stand still. You only need to be still in the chaos, and you'll know that I'm fighting for you. And these are real things that we need to wrestle with, because I think you know and I know that as we get to, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we know that we're not being still. We know that we're encouraged, if you're a teacher, to give more evidence for how you're living your life. We're encouraged in the workplace to validate our performance. Are you doing X amount of these? Are you doing, whether it's the health service or education or business, we're living in a society that's constantly saying, validate yourself, perform, work harder, go faster. And in the midst of that, how do we get through that? How do we navigate it? Well, we've got to see that we are to be still and trust and look to God when the armies are coming towards us, that actually we need to be still and allow God to fight for us. And that deliverance continues in 21 when we see that Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it to dry land. The waters were divided and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. You know, isn't it amazing that Moses was asked by faith to stretch out his hand? And I hadn't noticed this so clearly before, but it was all night that he stretched out his hand. I mean, can you just imagine how painful a cost that would have been, him holding out his staff all night, that he stretched out his hand over the sea and all night the Lord drove the sea back. You see, we can often see in films and cartoons that, oh, well, this is amazing. Moses is driving back the sea. Isn't that incredible? No, it wasn't Moses driving back the sea. It was God who was driving back the sea. Moses was sticking his hand out. Moses was sticking his hand out, but it was God driving back the sea with a strong east wind. And the waters divided across the Red Sea. And the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground. And we can kind of run over that stuff, but I just want to quickly talk about the humanness of that and imagine ourselves in that situation. Commentaries reckon that that divided sea is about 9 miles long. So I was reckoning that that would probably take you at the quickest about 2.5 hours to walk. If you stopped and had the odd picnic, maybe 3-4 hours, whatever, in terms of your walking pace. But it's a long way across that Red Sea. And we see these kind of cartoons that it's like, oh, here we are, here's the people of Israel, there's about 10 people, da-da-da-da-da, you know, like Tom and Jerry, and they'll cross it in a flash. You know, think about it, in 3 hours of walking through a gap in the sea where there's a wall of sea on right and wall of sea on your left, and think about your personality type in the middle of walking through that sea. Because some of us just love the outdoors and throwing ourselves off cliffs, and you'll be like, whoa, this is incredible. Check it out. There's a whale up there. And, oh, what a surf. That is incredible waves. That is just amazing. Oh, I'd love to be surfing on that bit, but I know we've got to stand and walk through the middle here. And then others of us will be like, oh, wait a minute. Did that bit of water splash in front of us? Are we going to be okay here? I mean, this is getting a little bit loud. This is getting a bit wet. This is getting a bit annoying. I mean, I know that Moses said we can walk through and God's with us and he's for us. Be sure it's not going to cave in after, like, I mean, come on, this has been like 1 hour, 10 minutes here. Surely, is this really going to hold for the whole time we walk from here to there? And some of us will be going, okay, well, let's just work out the physics of this. And you're doing a little kind of algebra. You know, I mean, this reality for them was so tough that they had to literally walk through it by faith. But the difference is, and really helpfully, Tim Keller says, that you are not saved by the quality of your faith, you are saved by the object of your faith. And that is really profound. Because some of us have grown up in churches that say, well, you've got to be a 10 out of 10 faith, you've got to be stronger, you've got to work harder, you've got to prove yourself somehow in terms of, well, I'm reading 6 chapters of the Bible a day, and boy, I'm really growing in faith. Oh yeah, I'm praying, I'm getting up at 4 in the morning, and what, you only pray on the bus, you slacker. But it's not about the quality of your faith, it's the object of your faith. And so for Christians, the object of our faith is Jesus. The object of the faith for those Israelites was Yahweh. It's the object of the faith. I'm putting my trust in God. I'm holding out the staff. I'm holding out the stick all night. I don't put the waters back, God, but you put the waters back. And can't we see the change in understanding of how deliverance comes about? You see, it's not that I save myself or you save yourself. It's not that somehow you improve your Christian life by yourself. It's that God, who is our object of our faith, works in us and grows us to be more like Jesus. He's working in us. And somehow, I think sometimes that we go on this spiritual roller coaster, and maybe you're on that roller coaster today, where one week you feel really high. Whoa, I'm really close to God. The next week, you're really down low. And then the next month, I'm on a season of a high. The next year, you're on a season of a low. And it's not about the highs and the lows. It's about the object of our faith is Jesus, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so when we trust in him, he never changes. But it's anchoring ourselves on the fact that he is the deliverer. Not that our circumstances determine what life is really about and how I should feel, but it's about the object of my faith. So that if my job is really difficult at the moment, or I don't have a job, or I'm not in a relationship, or my relationship is difficult, it's not about this thing that determines my life. It's actually my object of faith is Christ, and he is the one that enables me to grow, that he is the one who delivers me. He is the one that will make the difference, not the circumstances, be they good or be they bad. And that's not to negate that that's not difficult or not joyous, but it's Christ who remains the same. And then we think of verses 24 and 25. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down the pillar of the cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He jammed the wheels of their chariots so that they had difficulty driving. And the Egyptians said, "Let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." So the Israelites recognized Yahweh. They had 141 gods. It wasn't just, hey, oh, any old god will do. They came to the point themselves where they recognized that this God was the way, the truth, and the life. That it's Yahweh who delivers. They came to that point of realizing it's Yahweh, the Lord, is fighting for them. And 27 down to 28, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing towards it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. So the deliverance that God gives is total. It's not partial. It's not, I'll do a little bit for you and I'll come back. It's a total deliverance. He promised that he would take them, and he did that, and the sea went back and swept over them, and judgment came on them. Pharaoh is constantly trying to test God's patience and trying to determine that they will go in a different direction. But God is the deliverer, that God is the one who delivers them and delivers us. And then in verse 31, and when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him, in Moses, his servant. And there's this great quote by Spurgeon, which reiterates some of what I've been saying. My faith rests not in what I am, or shall be, or feel, or know, but in what Christ is, in what he has done, and in what he's now doing.